Good afternoon. Welcome to the 406th meeting of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations, both to our members and guests who are here today, and to our public radio audience reaching us through the good auspices of Maine Public Radio. Today's meeting of the forum comes to you from Point Lookout in Northport, Maine. I'm George Look, the president of the forum. The forum was founded in 1983 and is now in its 35th year of monthly meetings, featuring prominent speakers covering all aspects of foreign affairs and U.S. diplomacy. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. The Midcoast Forum extends a warm welcome today to Professor Carrie Emanuel, who will be speaking on hurricanes and climate change. Dr. Emanuel is a prominent meteorologist and client scientist. His research interests focus on tropical meteorology and climate, with especially in hurricane physics. His interests also include cumulus convection, the role of clouds, water vapor, and upper ocean mixing in regulation of climate, and advanced methods of sampling the atmosphere in aid of numerical weather prediction. Professor Emanuel received a Bachelor of Science degree in Earth and Planetary Sciences and a doctorate in meteorology, both from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. After completing his doctorate, he joined the faculty of the Atmospheric Sciences Department of the University of California at Los Angeles, where he remained for 3 years with a brief hiatus to film tornadoes in Texas and Oklahoma. He joined the faculty of the Department of Meteorology at MIT in 1981. And is a full professor in what has now become the Department of Earth, Atmospheric, and Planetary Sciences. He has been the director of the department's Center for Meteorology and Physical Oceanography, chair of its program in atmospheres, oceans, and climate, and is a co-founder of the MIT Lawrence Center, a climate think tank that fosters creative approaches to learning how climate works. Dr. Emanuel is a member of the National Academy of Sciences and of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Professor Emanuel is the author or co-author of over 200 peer-reviewed scientific papers, and he has written 3 books, including The Divine Wind, The History and Science of Hurricanes, published by the Oxford University Press, and What We Know About Climate Change, published by the MIT Press. Professor Emanuel, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Well, thank you very much, George. It's a great pleasure to be with you all here today. I'm conscious of the fact that I'm the only thing that stands between a large number of hungry people and lunch, and so I will keep my remarks fairly brief, and I have Bull Winkle back there whose fixed gaze will remind me not to stray from the straight and narrow. Hurricanes are one of my favorite topics, as you might have gleaned from that introduction, and before I begin the formal program, I think we don't need reminders of how influential these horrible events are in human history after what we've seen this last fall, but I would like to just note a few instances in which they have really changed the course of history. One of my favorite stories, I wish I had time to tell you more of these, is what happened in the 13th century when Kublai Khan twice tried to invade what is now Japan and failed in both cases. Actually, it was Japan back then as well, and with very massive fleets. And had he succeeded, in either case, Japan might very well be part of China today. He was defeated not by the Japanese, but by typhoons in both cases. And I could tell you other stories like that, but they have had an enormous influence in history. But today, what I wanted to do is talk a little bit more globally about hurricanes. What kind of hazard do they present? And then get on to the topic of today's talk, which is how climate change may influence hurricanes. What I won't be talking about, which is equally interesting to me, is how hurricanes influence climate. It turns out they may be really integral parts of the climate system and have important feedbacks on climate, which we're only now just beginning to understand. So we'll talk about inferences that we make from the historical and the geological record, inferences from basic physics. I'll tell you a little bit about those physics, and then using physics to estimate hurricane risk, because it turns out history is too short and poor to do this. And so we're trying to bring advanced physics to bear to estimate long-term risk and how it's evolving with climate. And then I'll wrap up with a discussion of the hurricanes of this past year in the context of climate change. So globally, these storms on average cause about 10,000 deaths per year since 1971, and about $700 billion in 2015 US dollars in damages. What's really disturbing to a lot of us who work on the interface of science and society is that the global population exposed to the hurricane hazard has tripled since 1970. Now, obviously, the whole population didn't triple, but everywhere you look, there's a wholesale migration to the coast, and this is vastly increasing damages and injuries, loss of life, and so forth from hurricanes. Now, if we look at the hurricanes in the Atlantic in the last year, the latest estimates released by NOAA just last week were that $305 billion in damages. It's about 10 times the budget of the National Institute of Health, which does all the research and things like cancer, and about two-thirds of the annual Defense Department budget. So it's a lot of money, not to mention all the misery that you all are aware of that continues to this day in places like Puerto Rico. And if we add up the damages across the Caribbean and the U.S., it's more like $380 billion in damages. Now, when we think about these storms and we think about the risks associated with them, what most people think about first is wind, right? And if you look at what happened in Puerto Rico, almost all the damage there from that storm was wind. But historically, most of the damage and most of the loss of life isn't from wind, it's from water, either in the form of freshwater flooding from rains, as happened in the case of Hurricane Harvey in Texas, or more commonly from a storm surge, which is essentially, you've probably heard that term before, people have a hard time visualizing a storm surge, but with these terrible videos you may have seen from the tsunamis in the Indian Ocean and Japan, the storm surge is the same thing as a tsunami. Hydrodynamically, it's the same phenomenon. The only difference is that it's driven by wind rather than shaking seafloor. So if you can imagine a tsunami arriving in the center of a typhoon or hurricane, that's the storm surge. You can't deal with it. People can't outrun it. It causes an enormous problem. And in fact, if you look at the statistics here in the United States of mortality, 1970 to 1999, most of it has been from drowning, either in salt water from storm surges or fresh water from floods, and a relatively small amount from wind. Now, it happens, and this is an interesting thing if you are like me, a researcher, is that wind damage in the United States and in much of the world is insured privately. If you have a homeowner's policy and if you read the fine print, it will cover you, or should cover you, against wind damage. But almost no private insurance in the United States and in much of the rest of the world covers water damage, and that includes most of the damage from hurricanes, from flooding. One consequence of this is that the insurance industry has done a really good job quantifying wind risk because it's in their, it's a part of what they do, right? But there hasn't been so much research done on water risks. And I'm trying to change that, and some of my colleagues are trying to change that by getting research scientists to get a little bit more applied and really have a serious look at these risks. And that's what I'll be getting to toward the end of my talk. So we can first ask a general question. Are hurricanes actually responding to climate change? And if that's true, how would we know that? Well, the first thing we would do naturally is turn to historical records. Now, I want to tell you a little bit about this. The historical records are far and away the best in the Atlantic. And it's important for you to remember, on the other hand, that only about 12% of the world's hurricanes, which are generically called tropical cyclones, occur in the Atlantic. But they still today get most of the press. So I'll talk about historical records in the Atlantic. Before about 1943, what we know about storms is almost strictly anecdotal. It's information we glean from newspaper accounts, from ship's logs, and from histories of coastal cities. There is no question that we missed a lot of storms that never made landfall or hit a ship and sunk it. So we know something happened, but we don't know what happened. So, you know, 1943 isn't that long ago. Beginning in the mid-1940s, we introduced routine reconnaissance of Atlantic hurricanes, and almost at the same time in the western part of the North Pacific, where we deliberately sent airplanes out into hurricanes to find out whether they were where they were, if they were there in the first place, and how strong they might be. And that continues to this day in the Atlantic. Okay, I've done quite a few of these reconnaissance flights myself. But in the early days, the measurements we got were pretty bad. We knew there was a storm out there. We actually couldn't measure winds. Interesting, if you're flying an airplane, how do you know how fast the wind's blowing? You only know how fast the airplane's moving through the air. You have to know independently how fast the airplane's moving relative to the ground, and we weren't able to do that technically until the late 1950s. By 1970, on the other hand, we had almost complete global coverage by satellites, both Earth-orbiting and geostationary satellites, so that since that time we've detected just about every storm that's formed on the planet. That's fine. We, on the other hand, aren't measuring them quantitatively. We don't necessarily know how strong they were. A step backwards in 1987, when we stopped sending aircraft into Western North Pacific hurricanes. The U.S. Navy used to do that, and for budgetary reasons and other reasons, stopped doing that in 87. Now, it's clear when you look through the history of the Atlantic that before about 1970, many storms were missed. If you look at the actual tabulated record, for example, the records from 1851 onward show a substantial increase in the incidence of what we call major hurricanes. These are Category 3, 4, and 5 hurricanes, the really strong, destructive ones. But if you, on the other hand, just look at the subset of those storms that made landfall in populous places, U.S., the Caribbean, the Lesser Antilles, for example, we see a much smaller increase. And we don't actually believe that there was a real difference between landfalling and non-landfalling hurricanes. What this is almost certainly telling us is that in the early part of the record, we were missing a lot of storms that didn't make landfall. And so a lot of the increase we've seen in non-landfalling hurricanes in the historical record is artificial because our detection of them got better over time. So many storms that did not hit land were missed in the early days. Now, if we look at the record post-1980, when at least in the Atlantic it became pretty good, what we see is that if we look at trends, the number of storms per decade, how did that change over time, we see that for storms that didn't reach an intensity of 90 nautical miles an hour, which is roughly 100 miles per hour, or less, there are no detectable trends in these storms. So if we look at the intense storms, the storms whose peak winds exceeded 100 miles per hour, we see that there is a statistically significant upward trend in those, which gets larger as you go to higher and higher threshold intensities. So we see quite large trends in the most intense storms. I'll tell you a little bit later in the talk, that was actually something that was predicted 30 years ago, that we would start seeing this kind of trend. We're beginning to pick it up in the data. Another very clear signal, which was predicted, is that hurricanes in both the northern hemisphere and in the southern hemisphere are peaking at higher latitudes. So in the northern hemisphere, they reach their peak intensity further north than they used to, and in the southern hemisphere, likewise, further south than they used to. And we think we understand why that's happening as well, but that has some interesting consequences going forward, that certain places may see, because of these trends, an increase in risk, but places deep in the tropics may actually experience a decrease in risk. I think I may have persuaded you, or perhaps not, that the historical records of these storms are really not up, for the most part, to detecting trends that we might relate to other climate signals. By the way, there's very known connections between natural climate variations like El Nino and hurricanes. El Nino strongly suppressed Atlantic hurricanes. That signal is very clear. But when we try to look for something like a global warming signal, we need longer records, and we don't necessarily have them. But the geologists are coming to our rescue here. And they've come up with a new field called paleotempestology, the study of ancient storms, by the way. My only contribution to the field is coming up with that name. So the only term I think that I made it into a dictionary. But I'm a big fan of it. And basically the way it works is, well, there are several different techniques. But as I've already told you, one of the really most consequential side effects of a hurricane making landfall is a storm surge. And not only does it wreak havoc with human beings, but also with nature. So if you have, say, if you can imagine a marsh or a brackish lake just inshore from the ocean, that happens all the time, by the way. If you look at the eastern seaboard or the Gulf Coast, you see, you know, kind of islands or sandbars that are separating the ocean from an inland body of water. So the storm surge will wash sand bodily into these marshes or nearshore lakes. And normally what's happening in these lakes is there's a steady growth of plants. They die, they sink to the bottom, become mud, okay? But then when the storm comes, it washes sand. And so if you go out into one of these marshes, as some of my colleagues do, with a rubber raft filled with graduate students and a coring device, they go down and they take a core and they get all this mud, but you see interspersed sand layers. And you can radiocarbon date the mud, and by that means figure out where, when and when the sand layers were put down. And in one case, in Vieques, an island off of Puerto Rico, they've been able to go back almost 7,000 years with this technique. So the problem with it is it's only been done in a few isolated places. We need a lot more paleotempestologists if we're going to put together a reasonable climatology with this. But we are beginning to see patterns in these records, periods of hundreds of years of relatively high activity interspersed with hundreds of years of relatively low activity, which we don't understand, but it gives us a nice challenge, puzzle to solve. Okay, so besides history and geology, we have basic physics, and I would say that the foundations of those basic physics were pretty well in place 30 years ago, relatively recent development. Hurricanes are giant heat engines, and a heat engine is nothing more and nothing less than a device for turning one form of energy, heat, into another form of energy, in this case, wind. And so most engines you are familiar with, in some sense, are heat engines. But what's the source of heat? The source of heat for a hurricane is the evaporation of seawater. Now, you might not think, it may not be intuitive to you that evaporation is a source of heat, but it really is. So if somebody were to throw a glass of water on your arm right now, the first thing you'd notice, even if the water were warm, is it would rapidly get cold, all right? Water's evaporating from your skin. It's evaporating from your skin, and it's drawing heat out of your body. And that heat energy doesn't disappear. It gets added to the air. And that's precisely what's happening in a hurricane. It's drawing heat out of the ocean by evaporation of water. And this is why hurricanes immediately begin to die when they move over land. There's no real heat source anymore. Now, it turns out that how intense you can make a hurricane really is governed. It's governed by a bunch of things, but the most important thing it's governed by is how fast you can evaporate water. The faster you can evaporate water, the more intense the storm. So the climate state dictates what this thermodynamic limit on hurricane wind speed is, and as you might think is intuitive, and you'd be correct, the warmer it is, the faster you can evaporate water. And so warmer climates can support stronger storms. And we've known that for 30 years. It doesn't mean that they will necessarily. It means they can. And so even 30 years ago, we suspected that the speed limit on hurricanes would start to go up, and it actually has, and that we'd start to see more intense storms than we've seen in the past. And that's happening, although not to our statistical satisfaction. So Haiyan, a big typhoon in 2013, when it occurred, was the most intense hurricane we've ever seen, or ever actually recorded. But that record was broken 2 years later in Hurricane Patricia in the eastern part of the North Pacific, which we were doing experiments, research experiments on at the time, actually broke Haiyan's record. So we keep breaking records, although we would not satisfy necessarily the statisticians at this point. From a Bayesian standpoint, we have a prior, which is we expected to see that, and the observations are beginning to show it. We can actually calculate from theory the speed limits on winds, and if we do that calculation for today, or more particularly the end of the last century, we see that in the places where you have the most intense possible hurricanes, like north of Australia, you could get theoretically a 210 mile per hour hurricane. That's sort of an upper bound in that. And that limit, if you go to higher latitudes, falls off very quickly to essentially zero. There's no way you could get a hurricane to form off the coast of Maine, even in a hot summer. It just can't happen. You can't evaporate water fast enough. But basic physics and climate models show that the speed limit in the tropics will probably, unless we do something, rise to something closer to 240 to 250 miles per hour by the end of the century. Okay, so these kinds of storms become possible, physically possible, that aren't possible today, just because we are raising the speed limit. So we would sort of summarize, and I mean, there's a lot more to it than I've led on, but I would say basically, from theory, we would say the speed limit increases with global warming. The incidence of high-intensity hurricanes should increase, and there is some indication that it is. The increase, for reasons I haven't gone into, should be faster in the subtropics than in the deep tropics. And another piece of physics, which is really simple, because warm air holds more water vapor than cold air, is that a given hurricane will produce more rain in a warmer climate. And that's a rather substantial, quantitatively substantial, in fact, about 7% increase in the amount of rain per degree of C, degree centigrade of warming. All right, so now what else can we do with physics? It turns out that we can actually use physics to do something that we find difficult to do with history, is estimate long-term risk quantitatively. So for example, what's the risk if you live on the coast of Maine, what's the risk that you get hit by a Category 2 hurricane over the next 100 years, or a Category 3 storm? Is that risk changing in time? And naturally, there are a lot of people and a lot of organizations that like to know that. Insurance companies come to mind first, but there are many other organizations. One thing you might think we could do is just use climate models. I mean, climate models are there to simulate climate, so why not use them to estimate hurricane risk? Well, there's a technical problem with that, and that is that the global models are just too coarse today to simulate hurricanes well. That is, their computations are performed at points that are about 100 kilometers apart in today's climate models. And you really need those computational points to be closer to 1 to 2 kilometers apart to do a good job simulating hurricanes. And just, we're not there. We can do that with a weather forecast model, and of course we do that, but not with a climate model that you have to run hundreds or thousands of years into the future. So we have a problem there. And what we do at MIT, and this is a technique that my group developed over the last 10 years, is we embed within this time-evolving climate model state, we embed a very detailed hurricane model that's got much, much finer resolution and was in fact invented to help forecast hurricanes. Long story behind that. And it's so fast and so efficient that we can use that climate state and actually literally generate hundreds of thousands of hurricanes. And I won't bore you with the details how we do. This is a map showing a mere 1,000 hurricane tracks generated by this technique, not from a climate model in this case, but from a global analysis of climate over the last 30 years or so. And we subject these synthetic tracks to all kinds of tests to see whether they behave like real hurricanes and on and on, and they do remarkably well with that. So we can now use these to estimate risk, because now we can at least get statistically robust things. And one test that I'll show you here, and this is a bit of a technical discussion, so I won't go into a lot of detail, is that what we do, which is demonstrably better than climate models, is that we capture the whole range of intensities, of observed range of intensities of hurricanes, not just the weak storms that the climate models can explicitly simulate, but the very strongest storms we can also simulate. Remarkably, we also capture the observed year-to-year variation of hurricanes. If we compare the year-to-year variation of Atlantic hurricanes produced by embedding this very detailed model in climate reanalysis data, we capture something like 65% of the observed variance from year to year. So it actually knows that about El Nino years being quiet and that sort of thing. And we've been able to show, sort of more on the scientific side, in very recently, something that may have caught your attention, that is the North Atlantic had a demonstrable hurricane drought in the 70s and 80s. In fact, last night at dinner, I was having a conversation with some folks about how that coincided with a period of extreme fogginess along the main coast. Oddly enough, we think the cause of the hurricane drought and the increased fogginess here in Maine was the same, and it was man-made, not carbon dioxide, but sulfate aerosol pollution, which is a byproduct of burning especially coal, but also oil and gas. And you remember the period when people talked about acid rain? That was also a byproduct of sulfate aerosols. And what we have been able to show is that when we started burning a lot of those, putting up these aerosols, it cooled the climate. It seeded fog along the coast of Maine, but the European aerosols cooled the climate of the North Atlantic and suppressed hurricanes. In a way, it was a good thing. In the 70s and 80s, we didn't have very many hurricanes. Unfortunately, it led to an explosion of growth in places like the coasts of the US. And when the hurricanes came roaring back, more recently, we were paying the price. Why did they come roaring back? Because of the Clean Air Act, or a series of Clean Air Acts. Believe me, I'm not saying that we shouldn't pass the Clean Air Act, but there was a silver cloud with a black lining, and the black lining was that by taking away the suppressing effect, hurricanes kind of came back into the picture. So let me now sort of wind this up by with a discussion of how we take this risk method and look at the spectacular storms of 2017 in the context of that risk and how it's evolving in time. And let me begin with Hurricane Harvey. So as you probably know, Hurricane Harvey produced more rainfall than any tropical cyclone ever observed in the history of the United States. It was a phenomenal event. And we can run this technique off of climate analyses of the late 20th century and estimate the probability of rainfalls and various things. So Hurricane Harvey over its lifetime produced on average about 840 millimeters of rain, almost a whole meter of rain in Harris County, which is the county that contains Houston. And we came up with a risk estimate that based on the climate of the late 20th century, this for Harris County would have been a once in 2,000 year event, which means literally that the annual probability of having an event like that was one in 2,000. That's what that actually means. But if we run this technique with climate models, we conclude that by the end of this century, if we do nothing to curtail the increase in greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, it would be more like a once in 200 year event, one in 200 probability. Still very rare, but 10 times more probable than in the past. By the way, other research groups using independent methods and the National Weather Service all agree that the Houston's flooding or that magnitude of rain was a very, very rare event by the standards of the climate of the late 20th century. Now, if we ask a related question, what's the probability of a rainfall of that magnitude anywhere in Texas, not just in Harris County? That would have been about the end of the last century, about a once in 150 year event. So not quite so rare, because of course you've got a much larger area to work with. And that likewise, that probability by the end of the century would increase to about one in 15 per year. So these are very substantial changes. Not a surprise whenever you have sort of a bell-shaped distribution and you shift it, the biggest changes you'll see in the tails of the distribution, but it's the tails that are destructive, so it's what we worry about. Hurricane Irma had 185 mile an hour winds, the second strongest storm ever observed in the Atlantic, the strongest outside the Caribbean, and it holds the world's record for the amount of time it sustained itself as a Category 5 storm, 37 hours. It totally blew away the previous record of some Pacific storm, which was 24 hours. So it was a big record breaker, and 185 mile an hour is not anything to sneeze at. By this technique, if you look at the probability of a storm of that intensity within a sort of 300 kilometer radius of a particular island in the Caribbean, then we would have estimated that that storm in 1990 would have been about a 1-in-800-year event, that magnitude of wind, and likewise rising about tenfold to 1-in-80 years by the end of this century. And Hurricane Maria, which, as you know, did a terrible amount of damage in the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico, had 175-mile-per-hour winds, and at its location, we think that was something like a 1-in-200-year event by the climate of the late 20th century, rising to 1-in-20 years by the end of the century, assuming that we do nothing to curtail the emission of greenhouse gases. So these are real consequences, not necessarily the worst consequences of climate change, but it's something to worry about. And by the way, I'm going to make an aside here about Irma. I just read a book written by a woman who lives in Tortola in the British Virgin Islands. She went around collecting stories just from ordinary people who survived that storm, and she's just published it. It's called The Irma Diaries, and it's one of the most amazing books I've ever read about people's survival. So especially if you know somebody who thinks he or she can ride out a Cat 5, make sure they get this book. Well, let me try to summarize so we have time for discussion. The observational record of hurricanes is just too short and noisy and of poor quality to make robust inferences of long-term climate signals. We can see El Nino and other things in it, but not global warming. It's just not up to the task. But satellite data, which are much higher quality, do show some trends, like migrations of peak intensities toward higher latitudes and some indication of an increase in the fraction of intense storms relative to weak ones. Recovery of proxies of hurricanes from the geological record is just, it's a young field. It just really has only been going for about 20 years. It's beginning to show us some interesting climate signals, so I have a lot of hope that we're going to get a lot out of that field. Theory demonstrates that the thermodynamic limit on hurricane wind speed rises with temperature. Observations show that it is rising. That limit, which we can calculate easily from climate data, is in fact going up. And we can also use physics to model hurricane risk both in the current and future climates. Rainfall of Harvey's magnitude in Texas was about a 0.7% annual probability in 1998, but it's projected to increase to 7% by 2090. And by the way, if you just assume that that increase is linear over time, then by this year, it already had increased from 0.7% to 3%. And people sometimes ask me, was Harvey caused by global warming? And I said, that's a question that has no answer. It's an ill-posed question. But we can, on the other hand, talk about how the probabilities are shifting over time. Irma's peak winds in the place that it occurred within about 300 kilometers of that place, very, very rare, probability of 0.13% in 1990, increasing to about 1.3% by the end of this century. Maria, at its location, would have had a probability of half of 1% in 1990, but 5% in 2090. So let me just say this, that if we just take into account the purely random or natural variability, we are going to see in the Atlantic, inevitably, periods of many years, a decade, even more, of relative quiet. Okay, and every time we have this, the people who are skeptical of climate will say, see, it's all over, right? That's guaranteed. It's human nature. You don't have to be a great physicist to make that kind of prediction. And that will foster across the board, as we have seen in recent years, a sense of complacency about hurricanes. This is the sad aspect of human nature, is we have short cultural memories today of events like that. But I would argue that the hurricanes of last year should serve as a portent of what storms will look like later in this century unless we do something to curtail the accumulation of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Very interesting talk and reason to be glad we live in Maine, I think, at least for in the short term. We're going to be collecting questions from the audience, and what I usually do is take my prerogative as a moderator to ask the first question. And I'd like to know to what extent there's international cooperation on climate change issues and hurricanes and on the possible mitigation effects.
I think that with the possible exception of our own country, alas, the cooperation on all of these things has been quite good. And in the research aspects of hurricanes, it's good across the board. I mean, I can tell you that the people I work with are all across the planet, okay? There are lots of people doing good work on hurricane research everywhere. On the policy side, it's a tough problem because we're basically asking our fellow man to do something that will cost something, that will have very little benefits to our own generation, but most of the benefits far downstream. And I don't think we're hardwired to think that way. I find a few cases, but very few cases in history where people have thought consciously about the welfare down further than about two generations. Of course, we care about our kids and what happens to them, but grandkids, great-grandkids, you find it harder and harder. There are some examples, but they're tough to come by. I probably dodged your question more than answered it. But
here's a question that I think is extremely relevant. What would you be your top several U.S. policy recommendations, given that you know and expect to know about hurricanes? What should we be doing?
So I'm privileged to talk to many people at MIT and Harvard and other institutions who are much more expert in policy and energy, the environment, than I am. And I can only give you an opinion that's distilled from what my conversations with them. And that is that we really need, first of all, to change the conversation. You could think it's a bit odd for me to advocating this, but I am, away from whether climate change is happening, because I think so far as science can address that problem, we have. You know, we've certainly been able to tell you there is a risk, and it's not trivial. We wish we could be more precise about it, but I don't think we're going to be. We should change the conversation from that to a conversation about energy. Because after all, what we really need to do is argue about solutions and not about the existence of the problem. I think if you do that, you would actually find some optimism because people I know who work in the arena of energy are optimistic for what strikes me as very good reasons. Not only can we solve this problem, but we can probably do so ultimately to the benefit of our economy. And certainly seeding the transformation of the $6 trillion annual energy market, its transition away from carbon into other carbon-free sources, seeding that to China is not in the economic interests of the United States. And that's, in fact, what we're doing now. You don't have to believe in climate change to understand that this is problematic. So away from climate, more conversation about energy.
Thank you. These are not terribly related, but it seemed to strike me as kind of getting at the same issue. One is, what about winter hurricanes with changes to Arctic winds or something like that? And when you combine ice melt with more intense hurricanes, what do you get? And do hurricanes cause a welling up enough to release frozen methane? So it's a broader kind of questions on the effects of hurricanes.
Well, to take the last part first, I don't know of any research that shows there's an effect of hurricanes directly on the release of methane from hydrates on the seafloor. There are other things, just warming of the water could potentially do that, but I don't think hurricanes. Winter hurricanes. Well, we have just experienced not very long ago a very serious winter storm, and that happens. And I've been interested in those storms for a long time. In fact, I ran a field campaign out of the Brunswick Naval Air Station when it was the Brunswick Naval Air Station back in 89, I think it was, to look at those storms. We understand them much better than we used to, but they're not hurricanes. Their energy source is very different. Their energy source is the contrast, horizontal contrast, of cold, dense air with warm, relatively light air. With a little bit of a turbo boost from evaporation from the sea in some cases. Frankly, we don't really know how these storms will respond to climate change. It's a pretty profound confession of ignorance. It's not for lack of trying, but there are two things happening with global warming that work in opposite directions insofar as their effect on that kind of storm. Surface temperature gradient is projected to decrease, and it is. The Arctic is warming much faster than the tropics. And that weighs for less intense storms. But the temperature gradient high up in the atmosphere is actually increasing, and for very good reasons, we understand. And that goes in the opposite direction. So some models show these storms getting more intense and frequent. Others, just the opposite. I have to tell you, in slightly embarrassed tones, we don't know the answer to that question. It's an important one, and I think we will figure it out eventually, but we haven't figured it out yet.
You presented the scientific evidence as fairly overwhelming, but are there serious deniers of hurricane physics findings, scientists, physicists that doubt these results?
The odd answer to your question is not anymore, and not because my colleagues and I have, you know, the evidence has overwhelmed that, but because the ones who are denying it quite literally have died in the meantime. I think it was Max Planck who said science advances when old scientists die. It's the only way you can really make progress, but not to make fun of that. But there's a very strong consensus on the points I was talking about. More numerous intense storms and more rain. We like to debate, and things we don't understand as well, like what will happen to the weak storms, which are far more numerous. Will they become more numerous or less? And we don't have a good answer to that question yet.
Here's an interesting one, because it notes that with 3 times the coastal population growth, what military or diplomatic challenges will be more or greater as hurricanes intensify, to the U.S., to other countries? You know, there, other than the cost that you've referenced here, what other effects are there, impacts?
Yeah. Well, of course, the most serious effects are the immediate loss of life. But the other things that we are actually beginning to see from this hurricane season is, we saw it with Katrina too, is that a great many people who survive these events quite understandably don't want to go back to the same place. I think 40%, only something like 40% of the people who evacuated New Orleans from Katrina didn't come back. I mean, New Orleans shrank. I think it's growing now, but it shrank in population. There are an awful lot of Puerto Ricans, as you know, who want to move to the United States. And if you went down to Puerto Rico, you'd absolutely understand why they do. Now, of course, it's already part of the United States, but you know what I mean, to the continental United States. Now, if you start seeing this happen around the world, not just in the Caribbean, but in the Western Pacific, the Indian Ocean, India itself. I'm working with a colleague of mine at Columbia University on the hurricane threat to Mumbai, which has never had a major hurricane, but easily could. You know, and if you destroy big populations like that, you're going to have big, you know, migration pressures, which, as we all know, have national security and economic ramifications.
Kind of a follow-up to that, and there are two of them here. One is, can we remain on the coast by changing how we build there? Or can major U.S. coastal cities really protect themselves against hurricane storm surges? Back to the, you know, engineering solutions, et cetera, to a problem.
Well, I'm going to put a little bit of a different twist on that, because I think it's an incredibly important question. You might, the United States has an almost uniquely bad economic problem with hurricanes. We don't lose many lives, fortunately, because we're very good at warning and evacuation. But we keep building more and more stuff on the coast. And the reason for that is crystal clear to the people who study it, is that we subsidize people to do that strongly and more strongly all the time. How do we do that? The National Flood Insurance Program insures against water, which I've told you is the main source of damage. Okay, it's been in place since 1968. It's very politicized. If they try to raise rates, as they did in 2014, so that this is a radical idea that premiums should reflect risk, you know, and the people in you know, hurricane-prone coastlines went bananas. Well, I can't really blame them. Some of their rates went up by a factor of 10 in a couple of years. And they had to back off on that. Many states, I don't know about Maine, but certainly Massachusetts, at the level of the state cap insurance premiums. What other businesses do you know where the government's telling you how much you can charge, or you can't charge more than X, all right? That's a subsidy. because the only people who are affected by the cap are people who are living in risky areas. And then federal disaster relief, which doesn't really make, in my opinion, the homeowner participate in the risk enough. They're all subsidies for that. As long as we keep subsidizing people to live in risky places, we're going to get more and more damage. It's kind of madness. I don't know how to stop it.
A number of people wanted to know how a particular weather events affected hurricanes. I'll read three to you and you respond in general. What effect do El Nino and La Nina years have on hurricanes? And when there's a lot of surplus heat throughout the tropics, why do hurricanes happen in one place rather than another?
Those are all really good questions. El Nino is known to suppress Atlantic hurricanes, and we actually understand why. It actually enhances hurricanes in parts of the Pacific Ocean, but in the Atlantic it suppresses them. And La Nina does the reverse, so we have more hurricanes in the Atlantic in the La Nina year. Now, we just did a study about whether hurricanes might have been more or less common in the early part of the Holocene, which is the most recent geologic era, just after the end of the Ice Age, when the Sahara, this is the question about desertification, when the Sahara was green. I mean, there's grassland. It wasn't a desert like today. There's lots of water there. And we did some modeling using, among other things, the technique I described to you, and showed that there were probably a lot more hurricanes when the Sahara was greener for some very interesting reasons having to do with desert aerosols over the Atlantic, and that if the desert becomes drier, which models don't agree on, by the way, the Sahara becomes drier, it would logically be fewer for that reason, but that's not known whether that will happen. And the third part of that question was,
Since there's surplus heat throughout the tropics, why do they form in one place rather than another?
Well, they tend to form in places where that surplus is more than in others. And the interesting thing is they actually help to wipe that surplus out. And the reason they do, I've already told you that hurricanes take heat out of the ocean, but that isn't the major way they do it. It's stirring cold water up from the depths. That's a big, big effect. And it has the effect of redistributing ocean heat content. And so they're kind of important regulators when you think of tropical ocean temperature.
Next question is, what can we do to reduce the number and intensity of hurricanes other than the greenhouse gas, decreasing greenhouse gas emissions?
So one thing we can do in principle is something called geoengineering. You might have heard of that. And one of the prominent techniques that have been proposed is to deliberately inject sulfur into the stratosphere the way volcanoes do. And that reflects sunlight and it cools the planet. And that, as we have seen, because we did the experiment, although it was with tropospheric aerosols, the hurricane drought of the 70s and 80s would almost certainly suppress hurricane activity. Whether we should do it is an entirely different question, but we, in principle, could do something like that.
Then this one's closer to home, and someone wants to know, as you say, Maine cannot produce hurricanes, or at this latitude, but don't the same physics apply to other types of storms, such as nor'easters, so that we can expect more severe storms even in our part of the world?
Yeah, I sort of answered that question because it was related to an earlier question. We don't know the answer about nor'easters. You know, we hope in 10 years, if you invite me back, maybe we'll know, but right now we don't. I do want to take the opportunity to correct a misapprehension I might have fostered. Hurricanes can't form off of Maine, but they can certainly come here and deliver a terrible punch. And that's because the ones that do that are traveling so quickly over the surface that they literally don't have time to spin down before they hit us. And so the coast of Maine is at risk. It's not nearly as much, of course, as Florida. And when we do simulations of climate change, it turns out that, oddly enough, the risk goes down in places like New York City, but goes up along the main coast due to changes in the projected tracks of storms. We have had some very violent hurricanes in Maine's history, but they're fortunately rare. I hope they stay that way.
Well, we've kept you out of politics so far, but of course we weren't going to do that forever.
Okay.
First of all, should offshore wind and or wave power be encouraged in Maine in light of the increased storm risk? Is it dangerous to start building additional infrastructure on the coast when we have these increased risks of storms?
Well, that's an excellent question. When Cape Wind was on the books down in Massachusetts, the Cape Wind people actually asked me to do an assessment of hurricane risk and how it would evolve. And all I can tell you is they took it very seriously, and they were trying to design their wind turbines to take the kind of storm you might expect every 200 years or so. There is a study, a published research study, that if you massively built wind turbines off the coast of Texas, that's what the study was concerned about, that it takes so much energy out of the air, even when the turbines were locked down, that the hurricane winds would be substantially diminished by the time the hurricane actually went on shore in Texas. So they were advertising it as a good thing. Unfortunately, it does some bizarre things to the rain field. So you're tampering with Mother Nature, not generally a good idea.
Well, never good to tamper with Mother Nature. Another even more political question. Are there important online climate resources that have been removed by the present administration?
Yes, demonstrably so. The data is still there. Some of the resources you can get to if you know the right person to ask, but the EPA's website, for example, on climate change was taken down. It's not a political question, it's a factual question. They were taken down.
A lot of politics involves facts and alternate facts. And finally, let me give you one that's maybe a little longer. To love to hear about what you have to say about what you wouldn't talk about, the impact of hurricanes on climate. The reverse of that. Are there a few words you could say on that?
I can. I mean, this is a budding field, and we know that hurricanes do two rather profound things to the system. They dry out the atmosphere, and not just hurricanes, but any kind of cluster of deep cumulonimbus clouds, by producing much more efficient rain, taking water out of the atmosphere much more efficiently than an ordinary rain shower. It ends up drying the atmosphere. Well, as you may know, water vapor is the most important greenhouse gas. So when you dry out the atmosphere, you actually start cooling the system. And this may be a kind of a natural regulator of climate in the tropics. And climate in the tropics on geological timescales has been much, much more stable than the climate of, say, our latitude here in Maine, or certainly up higher latitudes. That's one mechanism. The other, which is something my research group explored, has to do with this upwelling of cold water. You have more storms, the upwell cold water, and that cools the tropics. But the heat, turns out, that was there gets exported to higher latitudes or to different longitudes. And so it's another potential avenue for hurricanes to regulate the climate. But I want to emphasize, this is, I mean, in my field, this is considered really exciting research because it's new and it's potentially consequential, but we're really in the research phase of this problem.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Really appreciate your final comment. Thank you.